Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me as usual at the studios of CBS Interactive, Scott Rohde of PR agency House Party.
Hi, Tim.
And our guest today, planning guru John Steele.
Morning.
This week, will the GFC affect Aussie ads chances in Cannes? The Gruen transfer is back on air, but still in the doghouse with Clems. In TV, Australia's Got Talent bows out at number one. The World Cup bumps up ratings for SBS, and MasterChef continues its glory run. Brands hitch a ride with Foursquare. The value of a good PR event. Nova hands its budget to the listeners. And the extraordinary taxi ride campaign comes to an end. Now we turn first to John Steele, author of two industry near classics, Perfect Pitch and Truth, Lies and Advertising. Now, you know it's a good book when your colleagues steal it, which is what happened with Perfect Pitch. I reviewed it when I was on B&T magazine, and I can still remember exactly who it was who borrowed it and never gave it back, John. But before we talk about the art of pitching, it's probably worth just explaining how it is that you've ended up in WA of all places from a sort of global planning role in London. What brought you to Australia?
It was a bit of a surprise to Sir Martin too when I went to him to resign to say that I'd decided to move to Perth.
That was when you were in the WPP role.
That was when I was in the WPP role, working out of the London office, and he said, "Well, no need to resign. You know, stay working for us from Perth. We'll put a video conference in your house and just make it up as we go along." So I moved to Perth entirely for lifestyle reasons. I came there to watch the cricket 3 years ago, and despite the unhappiness of England getting completely trounced, I decided it was the place I'd always wanted to live but never knew existed.
Excellent. And how are you actually making it work? Can you do it as, from what some people would see as remotely as that?
I think with the kind of job I do, being remote and somewhat isolated is actually an advantage. I spend a lot of my time thinking about things. I spend a lot of time writing, and I do both of those things better when I can walk the dog on the beach and have time to not be interrupted by people.
And how much of your focus is on Australian clients and how much on global clients still?
Very little on global clients. I've retained a couple of responsibilities globally. My main WPP responsibility is running the Marketing Fellowship, which is a sort of Uber graduate recruitment program. We hire 9 or 10 people a year and have them spend 3 years with a year in each of three different operating companies, each in a different discipline, each on a different continent. I run that program, which is a fairly heavy load. And
have been Australians have taken part in that?
Yes, so we have two Australians in the program right now who both came out of the AFA's program. That's where we first met them. And throughout the history of the program, we've had several Australians in it. But then primarily I'm focused on George Pat's and building our Australian business.
And that's sort of spending some of your time in Sydney, presumably some in Melbourne.
Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and anywhere else where, you know, it seems to be a good idea for me to travel.
Well, I've hinted a little bit at Perfect Pitch. Now, the scene that sticks in my mind, and this is going to be horribly embarrassing if, in fact, I've got it mixed up with another book, is a couple of times I've read it, but was...
I do hope so.
Yeah, well, particularly as it's the idea of you sitting in a hotel bathroom at 2 o'clock in the morning organising your notes. So I do hope that was a scene from the Perfect Pitch, your book.
It's certainly a scene from my memory. Whether I wrote it in Perfect Pitch, I don't know. I've always said about Perfect Pitch and Truth, Lies and Advertising that if I hadn't written them, I wouldn't have read them, so my knowledge of them is sketchy.
Well, Perfect Pitch, what it attempts to do is give people, I guess, a sort of framework for pitching, which is something that it's not just advertising. People who work in ad agencies, it's the same for maybe a slightly lesser extent, but, you know, PR, media agencies.
I think it's broader than that. I mean, when I wrote Perfect Pitch, it started as a book about agency pitching, but I very soon realised that the lessons that need to be learned about successful pitching are as useful when asking somebody out on a date or as a kid asking your parents for money. Mm. I mean, it works in any form of human interaction where one person wants something from another that they weren't necessarily going to give in the first place. Mm.
Just basically change management then, where you're trying to convince
them. Yeah, it's about convincing people to think differently and act differently.
And one of the senses I remember getting, it's about finding the story to tell.
Yes. great presentation is all about storytelling, and all great stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. They have plot, they have characters, they have little parts of them that people go away remembering, you know, little phrases, ideas.
And have you ever been part of a disastrous pitch? And if so, what was it that went wrong?
Well, probably this is the one pitch that is both a great success and a disaster. It was a disaster because we didn't win it. We pitched the Persil OMO business in the UK, and well, globally, but from the UK. And 6 months was spent pitching, but it's a pitch that the agency should have declined in the first place, because the agency that was pitching it had no chance of winning.
That's half the battle, isn't it? Is knowing which fights you should be in.
I always say, when I talk to people about new business, I say, pitch only what you want and pitch only what you believe you can win. And in the 10 years I worked at Goodby Silverstein in San Francisco, we won 90% of our new business. The reason we did that was we turned down 4 out of every 5 opportunities we had to pitch. We only pitched stuff we were absolutely certain about. Occasionally, we'd make a mistake. Occasionally, another agency would pull something out of the bag to beat us. But on the whole, I think our judgment was right about those things.
Where do you stand on this pitch theatre thing, this idea that you can just wow the client by showing how much you care by putting everyone in silly costumes and holding up billboards or something?
Am I allowed to say bollocks on the
podcast? You certainly can, yes.
That's what I think of that. I'm all in favour of relevant theatre, but you know, relevant theatre doesn't generally include Peruvian, you know, pipe bands and the sort of stuff that I have seen agencies bring in for no apparent reason other than to make the client think they care. It's just distracting. If theatre has something to do with the idea, great. One of the best pieces of pitch theatre I've ever seen in my life was Johnny Cochran's defence of O.J. Simpson, and where O.J. was asked to put on the bloody glove, and Johnny said to the jury, if the glove don't fit, you must acquit. That's great theatre. It's great drama. It's great storytelling. And that piece of storytelling defeated DNA evidence that gave an 11 billion to 1 chance that OJ hadn't killed Nicole and Ron.
And is there a pitch that you're particularly proud of?
I'm proud of all the ones that we won, because a lot of agencies spend a lot of time trying to get their pitch perfect. And I know my book is called Perfect Pitch, but for me, winning's more important than perfection. Rich Silverstein was once asked by a client after he'd shown a campaign, Rich, is this the best campaign you could possibly have presented me? And Rich said, I don't know, is your wife the best woman you could possibly have married? you do the best you can at the time. And I'd rather pitch with an 80% idea that everybody's completely confident about. And for me, running a pitch, it's all about the confidence of my team. The ideas we present are important, but they're not as important as the confidence of the people presenting them.
Now, not everyone who's listened to this will necessarily be working in an ad agency, for instance. So not everyone will know exactly what a planner does. How do you define a good planner?
I define good planning, there's a distinction between a good planner and good planning, but a good planning is the application of common sense to the development of communications. I think planners have to keep an agency honest. They have to make sure that the agency is talking to the right people in the right way, at the right time, in the right medium. And that's always been a planner's job. There's lots of fragmentation of the discipline now where suddenly there are people who are experts in channel planning. I've always been a channel planner.
And is it something which comes naturally to certain people, or can it be taught to anyone?
It does come naturally to certain people, and it can't be taught to anyone, but it can be taught to a lot of people. I think the people to whom it comes most naturally are the ones who are naturally better listeners than talkers. And, you know, I've always said there's a reason why you've got 2 ears and 1 mouth, and planners should use that ratio perhaps better than account people do often.
And it's relatively early, but what are your impressions of the state of planning in Australia?
I've met some very good planners in Australia, and I've met some planners who I don't rate that highly. But I could say exactly the same about the UK and the United States. It's the state of planning in general, I think, is poor at the moment. And it seems to me to be poor because planners are headed in 2 directions. There's a lot of planners are fast becoming clients. You know, even though they're still working in an agency role with the word planner on their business card, they're effectively clients because they're so focused on one piece of business that they've got no perspective. And there's other planners who are just frustrated creative people who think their job's to just sort of hang out with creative people and be smart and, you know, dress in black and wear those funny little glasses and all that sort of thing. And they're not really very useful because the ideas they have aren't based on any sort of solid foundation. I mean, planning is first and foremost a research-based discipline. You have to be in command of the facts before you can start to interpret them. And I don't see enough discipline from the more sort of creative end of the planning spectrum.
And does some of this also come from the structure of agencies as well? You know, do you see on the whole that agency structure works as it is at the moment?
I suppose the success of planning in an agency has to do with the agency's commitment to it, planning's involvement at the most senior level of the agency, and the numbers of planners. I don't think most agencies have enough planners for planning to really make the difference that it needs to. For me, a planner can't work on more than two or three pieces of business and still have the depth of knowledge that's required to help people make intelligent decisions.
So it's a balance to strike then between being that client with one piece of business and not being too thinly spread that you're not close enough.
I don't think it's right for planners to work on one piece of business because then you become the client. But you can't be too thinly spread. You can't do planning on a project basis. That's why I'm not a planner anymore.
Who globally do you think does it well?
I think there's a lot of agencies who do it well. I think Goodby still does it very well. I think BBH does it very well.
And that's interesting.
Ogilvy
yeah.
does it well.
I was going to ask you about BBH because I know their model, for instance, in London is you almost feel that there's almost a mini media agency sitting in there with, people like Kevin Brown, for instance. Is that a model that could be applied to other agencies, do you think?
No, I don't think it's very healthy for any agency to base a model on a model that works at any other agency. Agencies work because of the people who are in them and the culture that's grown up. What works for BBH works very well for BBH, but I don't think it would necessarily work well elsewhere. I mean, when I joined Goodby as planning director, people said to me, are you going to introduce BNP planning to Goodby? Well, no, because A, they're in Britain and this is in America, and B, because Jeff and Rich and Andy, who were the creative partners, were very different people and required a different kind of planning.
If you were to set up an agency, how would it look?
I'd never set up an agency.
Why not?
I once had a very enjoyable weekend with a couple of guys, creative directors from Goodby, with whom we were thinking of starting an agency. And we spent all weekend coming up with this idea that we would be three of the four names on the door. And the fourth name would be an entirely fictitious character called Wilson, who was named after my cat.
As opposed to the volleyball in Castaway.
But this was before the volleyball in Castaway, so I got there first. but Wilson would have been a very sort of philanthropic, benevolent partner, but an absent partner, a partner who had to be consulted on all the difficult decisions, but who always held the casting vote. And we would say, no, we have to defer to Wilson on that. And we'd put pictures in his office of him. He's on safari in Africa, and he'd be this enigmatic person who no one would ever meet. We had so much fun talking about that and then decided not to start the agency.
So, in a couple of weeks in Cannes, I suspect that our luck or skill at avoiding the worst of the global economic downturn will probably be reflected in a lower award tally because I guess our reduced fear takes its toll on our propensity to take creative risks, which is why we need to get rid of Kevin Rudd, because he saved us from the worst of the... that's another seminar. Simultaneously, though, other more nervous countries, and this is just my hypothesis, right, because a lot of countries doing it really tough, I think simultaneously, while we've been just narrowly avoiding the worst disaster of all time, other countries that haven't will be demonstrating their need to try something new. So I'm predicting that we'll have a really moderate year.
Now, last week, BWM's Rob Belgiovanni gave the slightly disheartening prediction that the Aussies would fall flat at Cannes this year because of the recession. Speaking at Creative Sydney, he said that our reduced fear takes its toll on our propensity to take creative risks. Really, I think he was making the argument that Australia's had it pretty good, so hasn't had to think too hard. John, is there a value in international awards anyway? Are you a believer in awards?
I'm a great believer in awards for their ability to attract top creative talent to an agency. I don't think they mean as much as agencies think they do to clients, and I personally have got little interest in them at all.
Have you ever been to one?
I've won a couple, but I didn't go and collect them.
Yes, awards are for winning rather than for judging.
Yeah, I judge. I'm the chairman of the APG Awards for this year in Australia, so I will be getting involved in that, and I'm involved in the Effies as well. I'm more interested in effectiveness, which I think is more useful to the industry. We have to prove to clients that advertising actually helps build business, and I think a lot of clients have lost their belief in that. But swanning around Cannes for a few days, I don't think helps that cause at all. I've never been to Cannes, never intend to.
Now, Scott, on Cannes, it's been a couple of years since PR yep. became a category in Cannes, and so far Australia it's been represented in terms of the jury, and again, Simone from Mango/DDB will be there this year. What's your sense of why PR agencies don't seem to be throwing themselves in from Australia?
I think, again, it's similar to the ad agency. It's sometimes it's a lack of fight in Australia. In the UK, there's a lot more agencies, there's a lot more battles going on, there's a lot more creativity at times, I find, and in the US. And it's similar to, I suppose you can compare it to the press in Australia as well. You know, there's little competition, and because of that, there's less fight in most of the people involved to actually get what they actually need to do and get out there. And don't get me wrong, there's some amazing agencies in Australia, but a lot of the ideas are copied from the UK. And if you're going to copy ideas from the UK, then the chances are you're not going to get into Cannes because you're just replicating another person's idea.
Well, that's where we leave it with John, who has another appointment. So, John, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the podcast. I hope to have you back another time.
Thanks, John.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you.
Next up, we talk the Gruen transfer. Now, in a guest posting on Mumbrella this week, one of the people behind the Gruen transfer, John Casimir, argued that Adland has nothing to fear from it. Now, as it happens, as we're recording this, I can't actually tell you what the ratings were because at the time of recording, there'd been a technical glitch with the ratings, so Wednesday night's ratings were actually delayed. But as it was up against State of Origin, I don't think we can expect massive ratings. But, Scott, to address the point that John Casimir raised, which we asked him to address, do you think the Gruen transfer is good for the communications industry?
Yeah, I think it is, actually. I think it gives people an insight into what they do. I mean, that's a key for it. I mean, a lot of people just think an advert is the thing that they see on a TV, is something they see on a billboard, is a communications message that gets hit with them in the papers. But, you know, they don't see all the hard work that goes into the planning, the actual getting how many people are involved in it, the thought process behind it. You know, there's so much involved that most people don't have a clue about that, which I think the Gruen transfer gives them that ability to see some of the things behind it.
Next, we chat about some more TV headlines. Now, still with TV, SBS got its highest ratings of the year so far, as 1.1 million Aussies got out of bed to watch the Socceroos get thrashed. I don't think that Tour de France is going to beat that. Also this week, Australia's Got Talent had its grand finale, and that took the number one spot on Monday, pushing down MasterChef, although it does stay at number one for most nights. But first, to the footy. Scott, how's your World Cup so far?
It's been very tiring, to be perfectly honest.
Have you watched any of it in 3D yet?
Not yet, actually. I just haven't. I keep forgetting, to be perfectly honest. And I'm trying to find the SBS page that lets me know when the 3D is, but yeah, I don't know which one it is.
Because it's not every game, is it?
No, it's not. It's only, I think it's 12 or 16 of the games, but yeah, I think it's mostly the finals, semi-finals and that kind of stuff. So I'm just waiting to try it out then. But I was, you know, I've watched most games, I think, in this World Cup so far. It's playing havoc with my sleep patterns.
Now, a couple of things. One of the things that struck me was, you know, that level of hope and expectation beforehand. You know, we're seeing all those, you know, that huge number of Socceroos ads, for instance, here in Australia. And then, of course, you see them lose 4-0 to Germany. You wonder whether they're going to get out of the group. For marketing companies, it's a big gamble, isn't it? You put a lot of money into a promotion, which could die in, you know, quite quickly.
Well, I think one of the things you should be thinking about if you're an advertising if you're actually a company about to get some advertising is, you know, build it up slowly. You know, if you know your first game's against Germany, one of the world's top teams, then maybe you don't want to be pushing out that too much. You know, build up towards the next games when you've got a bigger chance of winning. And
I suppose the thing is you want to get it out of the way before you're out of the tournament.
Oh, absolutely. But one of the things was, I mean, you look at the press over here, and it reminds me actually of the press back in Scotland when Scotland go up against the big hitters in the world. And, you know, although they play better against the big hitters, and we usually lose to teams like Georgia or Faroe Islands, which has like basically 150 people, and 11 of them play football, and we got beat by them. Then we beat France twice in a year. But Australia, the media seems to build them up as this, you know, this behemoth to go out and just flatten the opposition. And then you watch them on the pitch and they were terrible. You know, Cahill deserved to get sent off, you know, 5 foot from behind, sliding tackle from behind, not on. Watching Lucas Neal's knee in the back was just outrageous, and he got away with it.
But the thing is, as I saw it, my first thought was, there are 1,000 marketing managers, dreams are dying.
Yeah, absolutely. God, if I'd put an advert in there, I'd been like weeping openly. The thing is, though, what shocked me the most with this entire tournament was SMH yesterday.
Sydney Morning Herald.
That was absolutely despicable. I watched the New Zealand game and I thought that was a brilliant comeback.
We'd probably better explain what you're talking about, because yeah. I think it was a bit of fun.
I don't think so. I think if you were a Kiwi, you'd be furious. So,
they gave the score as
the game was New Zealand versus Slovakia. The score on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald was Australasia won, Slovakia won.
They were clearly being self-deprecating and
they
joking.
They were not.
This is rather like when Andy Murray's winning in the tennis, everyone in England is British, and when he loses, he's Scottish.
Yeah.
It's one of those things, they're poking fun at themselves. They weren't honestly claiming New Zealand as themselves. I've seen they've taken a hammering on their letters page,
but let's think they were joking. Let's think about this. And I've discussed this with you before. Your average reader isn't the brightest.
So you're saying that you cannot do irony because you have to pander to the lowest common denominator.
Not exactly.
Next, social media. Well, it seems that social media is continuing its rise and the brands just can't get enough. This week, Microsoft organised a Foursquare swarm to bring together mayors of Foursquare. They were all invited to come along to Martin Place in Sydney in return for a free copy of Microsoft Office 2010. Scott, good strategy, do you think?
I think so. I've kind of stopped using Foursquare a lot these days because I just can't be bothered. And it's like a video game to me. You know, the object, at first it was like a video game where you'd check into new places all the time, but once you checked into the standard places you always check into, then you've got no chance of going up the leaderboards because, you know, you just realise that you spend your life going from the same places day to day and it gets quite depressing.
And what about for this event as a PR event? 141 mayors came along and checked in. Doesn't sound like a huge number.
It doesn't sound like a huge number at all, but then again, it's the early adopters that are using Foursquare at the moment. So you've got a lot of people who are the mayors of a lot of places. Like there's a person on Twitter called Frank Sting, who if you're anywhere in Sydney, you'll have seen either a piece of advice from him on Foursquare or you'll have seen that he's the mayor somewhere because he seems to be the mayor of about 100 places.
I think he sneaks into people's homes at night.
I wouldn't be surprised. But then there's people like, I happen to know a certain person who will remain nameless, who checks into a brothel every day because it's next door to his work. I know he does it for a laugh.
Yes. But the other social media thing that went on this week that became a bit discussed in mainstream was the Twitter election, the Penrith by-election, Twitter conversation with Christine Keneally, KKK, and Barry O'Farrell. Is Twitter a forum you can have a serious, detailed debate on? Or was that a stunt?
I think it's a stunt. I think to get, unless you're really, really good at condensing your argument, then I think it's not really the best place. Don't get me wrong, it's a good place to have people watching what's going on, and it's a good place to get your messages out, but I don't think it's a place to have a serious debate.
Next, we talk more traditional PR.
Hmm.
Looking back at the various events you've been to or been involved in, what would you see as the best PR event ever?
Obviously, the Quantro Ball was the most famous series of parties in Australia. They ended in 99. It was back when people had a lot of money, brands had a lot of money to spend on these decadent nights. And it's a shame it's sort of not like that anymore, but I was very, very happy to have been there and seen it.
Now, that was me chatting to Social Diaries' Tiffany Farrington on the Mumbo Report. Now, Scott, you're a PR who's very much about relationships with the journalists, and I know that you'd also say you're still a journalist as well. What do you see as the value of big PR events, parties, those sorts of things?
Well,
is there a place for them? Do you take them seriously?
I tend not to most of the time. Look, they get coverage, which is obviously the main point of what a client wants. But I think a lot of the times they're just that whole... God, this is where I'm about to get into a lot of trouble, but you know what? I don't care right now. I think a lot of marketing... Oh, not a lot. I think I've met a few marketing people in my time who actually just want to be in the social pages. So when their PR agency suggests that they do a big launch and they've got the social pages lined up, then the client's deliriously happy.
So it's not strategic. It's just about making the client happy.
Sometimes, yeah. I think look, there's other occasions where I know for a fact that marketing, some people, some clients, you know, you might get them some of the most amazing coverage and they aren't happy unless their person they work with or their neighbour or somebody says, oh, I saw this in the paper, blah, 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 blah. And they go, ah, then what I'm doing is working. But, you know, you could show them, you know, you get them 6 million views or whatever, and then they go, yeah, that's not great because these weren't the markets I wanted. But then suddenly their dog barks at them and tells them that was an awesome ad, and they're like, that's a brilliant thing, and they're delighted. And it's just human interaction. It's people want to be feel as though they're doing something good with their life and with their job, and I think that that's one of the things. That was a big ramble, I'm sorry.
That's quite okay.
I didn't sleep a lot last night, so I'm kind of on edge.
Next, we talk marketing with a twist. In an intriguing marketing campaign, the Nova 969 Merrick Dawes and Ricky Lee breakfast show in Sydney are handing over their $250,000 of their marketing budget to the listeners. And they'll invite the listeners to do whatever it takes to promote the station, and they'll give them their budget that way.
Merrick Dawes and Ricky Lee have made a rather impulsive decision
to give away their entire $250,000 ad budget
to Nova listeners.
$250,000, we don't want it.
The biggest cash payday in Sydney radio history is about to be made.
We don't want to give it to people we don't know. We want to give it to you.
That's a great idea.
Real people with proper job titles and qualifications have acknowledged that maybe the idea of giving away cash old school is maybe not such a stupid idea for the talk up.
Start thinking.
And get prepared to work for Merrick, Dawes and Ricky Lee for love and money.
It all starts soon.
Do it for the love or the money? Or do it for both?
I'd do it for both.
The love of money.
I'd do it for money.
Yeah.
Nova 969. Sounds different.
Good stunt, Scott.
Yeah, I think it's a very good stunt. And to be honest, he couldn't do a worse job. The ads I saw for the show last year were, or earlier this year, were just crap.
The Moon Man Milk ones?
Yeah.
I like them.
I didn't like them.
I like them.
No, didn't like them at all. And I didn't like their, yeah, I didn't like their those casting the shadows and stuff. Didn't like that, and the bus shelters either.
But you still remember them?
Yeah, I remember them as crap, and I mean, not to listen
can't...
to the show.
I bet you can't remember any other breakfast shows ever.
Yeah, I can remember most of them.
Okay, go on.
You can remember the Kyle and Jackie O ones with them looking smug as shit.
Yeah, that's Bollocks mainly
was,
just them looking
Bollocks
smug.
Was said earlier,
it?
Something I like to see. I think you remember most of them, I think, because I tend to do a lot of driving, so I'll see them in the back of buses. But I think let's see what they can do, shall we? Let's see what the creativity of the people can do.
And one other slightly unusual campaign this week, the Tourism WA Extraordinary Taxi Ride, which saw a cabbie take passengers on a 9-week journey across Western Australia, seems to have done its job. They claim that it generated, and this will have a debate, I'm sure, $2.6 million worth of publicity and reached a potential global audience of 60 million people. Now, regardless of the numbers, and I know that you know you always have to be sceptical about PR values of publicity.
I think the potential global audience of 60 million.
Yeah, good campaign.
Pretty damned huge, to be honest,
but
calling that one.
Good campaign, though? Good
yeah,
idea.
Yeah, good campaign. Like, as I've said before, you know, I think One Green Bean do good work at times.
It was One Green Bean and their sister ad agency host.
Yeah.
We came up with this idea of this cab driver taking people on this.
Yeah. Good campaign. You know, the 2.6 million is obviously reached by doing the old three times advertising ratio, by the looks of it. But, you know.
Which is discredited?
A lot of times, yes. It's discredited by the PRIA and a lot of other agencies.
Would you ever use it?
I have used it in the past, mainly because a lot of clients want some kind of measurement in that sense. And it's hard just to say, you know what, lots of people read this. And, you know, it's one of those things. It's a lot of clients want it, and you've got to be like, you know, they're used to the advertising model. The CEO's used to advertising model, and you have to come up with some way to balance it.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to my co-host, Scott Rohde.
Thank you very much.
And to our guest earlier, John Steele. That was the Mumbrella Cast. Thanks to CBS Interactive for their studios as usual. I'm Tim Burrows. Production was by Georgina Pearson. Toodle-pip.